Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Many nations put money into the till aimed at helping Syrians caught in the crossfire. The United States will provide over $925 million to help Syrians trapped by civil war and assist neighboring countries struggling to cope with the crisis. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced the contribution Thursday at the International Donors Conference for Syria in London.
Today, the United States is announcing our latest contribution, which is over $925 million. That includes more than $600 million in direct humanitarian aid to provide food, shelter, water, medical care, and other vital relief to millions of people inside of Syria and across the region. It also includes $325 million in development assistance, $290 million of which is new funding specifically to support schooling for 300,000 refugee youth in Jordan and Lebanon.
As the conference came to a close, British Prime Minister David Cameron said overall donors had pledged $6 billion for this year alone and a further $5 billion to be spent by 2020. This event took place just hours after the United Nations called off the fractious Syrian peace talks in Geneva until the end of February. U.S. envoy Stefan de Mistura, who was alternating between discussions with representatives of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and opposition groups trying to overthrow him, called the delay until February 25th a temporary pause and not the demise of what had been the first Syrian peace effort in 2 years. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The Syrian civil war appears to have entered a new and perilous phase for rebels battling to oust President Bashar al-Assad. Government forces backed by Shiite militiamen from Lebanon and Iran pressed an offensive Wednesday in northern Syria after breaking a three-year siege on two towns 30 kilometers northwest of Aleppo, the country's one-time commercial capital, in what one rebel commander described to VOA as the most furious fighting in northern Syria over the past 5 years. Government forces managed to lift not only the insurgent siege of the Shiite towns of Nabl and Nara, but in the past 24 hours seized nearby villages, severing the Aleppo rebels' main supply line to Turkey. An Israeli court has jailed two Jewish teenagers, one for life, the other for 21 years, after over a revenge murder of a Palestinian teenager in Jerusalem that helped trigger the 2014 Gaza War. The two defendants, whose names were withheld from publication because of their age, and an adult ringleader were found guilty in November of the abduction, bludgeoning, strangling, and burning of 16-year-old Mohammed Abu Qudair. Prosecutors said all of the accused had confessed, calling the July 2, 2014 murder revenge for the killing days earlier of three Israeli youths by Hamas in the occupied West Bank. 12 Pacific region trade ministers signed the Trans-Pacific Partnership in Auckland, New Zealand Thursday. The pact represents a broad free trade deal that will cut taxes and trade barriers for nearly half of the world's economy. Trade Representative Michael Froman signed for the U.S.
I'm confident at the end of the day because of the strong benefits to the U.S. economy, which have been estimated to be over $130 billion a year of GDP growth, as well as more than $350 billion of additional exports, that members of Congress will see the benefits for their constituents and will have the necessary bipartisan support to be approved.
Parliaments and legislatures of all 12 countries must ratify the deal. There are opponents who say the pact will cost American jobs and flood the U.S. market with foreign products. Spanish officials say a pregnant woman is among the seven people identified as being infected with the Zika virus there after visiting affected countries. The health ministry says in a statement that the woman traveled to Colombia, was presumably infected during the trip is in her second trimester of pregnancy. The statement Thursday said she was under medical supervision in the northeastern region of Catalonia, said the woman was in good condition but had no details about the condition of her unborn child. The ministry says the number of cases diagnosed so far are within expectations and do not pose a risk for the virus to be spread throughout Spain. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suleheeb coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Like all epidemics, it's really quite difficult to tell. For example, at the beginning of the Ebola epidemic or meningitis epidemic, really the experts find it difficult to predict how big that's going to be. But I think it's certainly WHO was right to take this very seriously and that there really is a threat from this.
That's Brian Greenwood, Professor of Clinical Medicine at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, talking about the threat posed by the Zika virus. Details coming up.
Also, Burundi's government wants allegations of Burundi's refugees being recruited by rebels investigated, and a previously unknown large pride of lions has been discovered in Ethiopia.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Senegal, and our daily features, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour. For some time now, there have been allegations that Burundians are being recruited in Rwanda, including in refugee camps where tens of thousands have fled to avoid fighting in Burundi. Today, Burundi's Foreign Affairs Minister Alain Nyamitwe called on Kigali to allow investigations into the matter. Tensions have grown between the two countries since last year when Rwanda accused its neighbor of sheltering FDLR rebels from the DRC. Moses Habayarimana reports from Bujumbura.
Burundi government has continued to accuse neighboring Rwanda of hosting coup plotters and militarily training Burundians who could after attack their own country to oust the government of President Pierre Nkurunziza. However, today, Burundi's Foreign Affairs Minister, Alain Nyamitwe, asked Rwanda, if the allegations are not true, then why would Rwanda reject the investigations?
I recall that it was Rwanda that that requested that a joint verification mechanism of the ICJLR be sent to Burundi to investigate the presence of the FDLRs. Well, they came, they didn't see anything, they left. Now we as government have asked for the same mechanism to go to Rwanda to verify the allegations of the presence of the Burundians who are being recruited and trained into military exercises and sent to Burundi to attack the country. But of course, as you recall, Rwanda has rejected that decision of the RIMC, which is the Regional Interministerial Committee of the ICJLR, taken on the 5th of September last year. So I believe the allegations of that country's involvement in matters of involvement against our security and stability is not just what we say as a government. It is reported by even independent panels. The last one being the UN expert panel, which finalized the report, which was seen. Again, we are not just bluffing. What we're saying is something that we can verify, that we can check. If we are wrong, then so be it. But I can tell you that we are not just bluffing. We know that what you are saying is something that you can verify, that you can check and double check and confirm.
Burundi has experienced a decrease in violence ever since the beginning of the new year. However, targeted assassinations and grenade explosions have continued to be heard in the capital. The government says it has evidence of Rwanda's involvement in the instability, but Kigali has repeatedly denied its involvement in the crisis, saying that Burundi should solve its own problems.
We continue to make noise if necessary, so that that country will stop those activities, because we believe that those activities are not in any way going to improve the quality of our relationship. They are our neighbors. We have to live in peace and harmony.
The foreign minister's comments come as at least four people were injured yesterday in a grenade attack along Patrice Lumumba Highway in the capital. The Newswire report another attacks on Bujumbura bus terminal. Last week, the African Union Heads of State Summit suspended the proposed deployment of 5,000 members of peacekeeping mission to Burundi and urged the Bujumbura to put an end to the current violence through inclusive dialogue with the opposition. The African Union is to send high-level delegation to Burundi in efforts to find for the long-lasting solution for the peace in the country. For VOA Africa, I'm Moses Havyarimana in Bujumbura.
Health officials are moving quickly to raise awareness about the Zika virus, which is spreading rapidly in the Americas. The World Health Organization says there could be up to 4 million cases this year. Research is underway to determine whether the mosquito-transmitted disease indeed causes severe birth defects. Also, the World Health Organization is concerned about reports in the southern United States of Texas that Zika may have been sexually transmitted. The virus was discovered in Uganda's Zika forest in 1947, but scientists say it's never been a major problem on the continent. There's speculation that the virus in the Americas may be a different strain, but further studies needed to confirm that. Among those following developments is Brian Greenwood, professor of clinical medicine at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. From London, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about the threat posed by the virus.
Like all epidemics, it's really quite difficult to tell. For example, at the beginning of the Ebola epidemic or meningitis epidemic, really the experts find it difficult to predict how big that's going to be. But I think it's certainly WHO was right to take this very seriously and that there really is a threat from this. But one can never be certain.
Now, you say the WHO is taking this seriously. Yes. Is it taking it more seriously, for example, than the H1N1 flu risk or MERS or something like that?
I think so, and I think the Ebola episode probably played a part in that because, as I'm sure you realize, the WHO was criticized for being too slow in starting that, and that may really have had some influence that they didn't want to be caught out again. But it is difficult. If you call something really serious too soon, then you get blamed, and then if you don't do it too soon and it really does go into a big epidemic, then you get blamed again. But I think probably that this was wise to be cautious and really to take this pretty seriously.
So when you say take it seriously, what exactly does that mean? What can be done?
Well, I think part of it is to produce information so that people get properly informed and to know what the risk is, what they might do about it. And I think that's happening. There's been a lot in the press on that. Generally, it's been pretty well-informed press, and that definitely helps. Otherwise, one gets panics and people start having irrational ideas. So there are a few things that can be done, and I mean, if you like, I can go over those.
Absolutely.
Well, as I think most people will know, this is spread by a mosquito. It's one particular mosquito that tends to live around people's houses in flower pots and dirty water. Obvious thing that one can do is to try to control the mosquitoes breeding around the house, something that everybody can participate in. If you're living in an area where this is thought to be happening, avoid getting bitten by mosquitoes. These ones can bite pretty well at any time of the day. They tend to bite more in the evening and in the morning, but one needs to be aware that they can bite any time. And so taking precautions, sleeping under a bed net, wearing long sleeves and trousers, I mean, I gather it's sort of carnival happening in Brazil this week, and people are pretty worried there about lots of people wandering around without too many clothes on and things. So, I mean, there are simple things that one can do like that that reduce the risk, although they won't reduce it completely.
Can you take what's been learned about malaria and apply it to Zika?
Probably not so much malaria, because it is a different mosquito which has different habits, you know, and that's one of the things we learn in infectious disease control. You really must know your enemy and how they behave and so on before you start planning your interventions. Mosquitoes that transmit malaria behave in a different way. Most parts of the world, they bite in the middle of the night, and so mosquito nets are much more effective than they would be against the Aedes mosquitoes that transmit Zika. And so I think the closest parallel is with dengue virus infection, and that is transmitted by the same mosquitoes. And so some of the control measures that have been used for dengue will be used for controlling Zika. Those are primarily directed at that group of mosquitoes.
Has a link been definitely established between Zika and the birth defects?
Reading the general scientific literature, I haven't yet seen anything that absolutely proves that. And I think most of the responsible scientific journals in their editorials and things are saying it's probable, but it hasn't absolutely been proven yet. But to me, it seems pretty likely. But it is odd. I mean, odd, this hasn't been seen before for an infection that's been around for probably hundreds of thousands of years, why it should have just happened now. So we do have to have just a little bit of caution. And there are ways, epidemiological ways, that can actually help to strengthen the link. But it isn't easy. You know, it took a long time with smoking and things before it was really conclusively proven that that was causing cancer. I know groups are beginning to work on that, and I think we'll get some much stronger data fairly soon.
Is Zika, in your view, more dangerous than the flu virus, which we know kills a lot of people every year?
I don't think it is. I mean, it is horrible for the, you know, the mothers and the families who have one of these babies. And if it really is, it's a tragedy if that happens to those families. But that's not on the scale, really, of the major influenza or, you know, what the SARS virus might have done if that had really spread and not been contained. Because that really is attacking the whole population, killing lots of people and disruptions to the society. And this is nasty, but isn't as bad as that.
Do you expect vaccine research to go into high gear now?
Yes, I do. I mean, I've been a little bit involved in the Ebola vaccine. I've been doing some work on that, sort of see how that happened. And I think, again, there have been lessons learned. And I'm quite sure that the groups who have had a little bit of experience that will be really pushing hard. Donor organizations will be helping with that. But you can't just do it in a year or so, something like 5 years or so before there is a vaccine. We're going to have to rely on mosquito control rather than just hoping there's going to be a vaccine around the corner very soon.
That was Brian Greenwood, Professor of Clinical Medicine at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine from London. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Burundi's government wants allegations of Burundi refugees being recruited by rebels investigated. And health officials are moving quickly to raise awareness about the Zika virus. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The German Interior Minister says the numbers of migrants and refugees entering the country have slowed. More than 91,000 asylum seekers arrived in Germany last month, compared to about more than 127,000 in December. Officials say harsh winter weather was the driving force behind the decline. More than a million migrants and refugees have entered Germany in a year's time, more than any other European country. The nation has a population of about 80 million. Chancellor Angela Merkel says diplomacy is key to lowering the numbers and hopes for a cap on refugee numbers. The government has also toughened its asylum policies. Last week, Ms. Merkel said Germany expects Syrians and Iraqis to return home when Syria's civil war is over and the Islamic State group is defeated. Sweden's immigration agency says up to 140,000 may seek refuge in that country in 2016. Agency officials say it expects that 27,000 will be unaccompanied minors. It has been one of the top European destinations during 2015. French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve says the government has dismantled 25 migrant smuggling networks in the country's north in the past year. About 700 smugglers worked in networks in the Calais region, where an estimated 4,000 hope to slip across the English Channel to England.
The Associated Press News Service says hijackers who commandeered the Greek-owned oil tanker Leon Diaz last Friday have abandoned the vessel near the coast of Benin and taken five crew members hostage. The kidnapped captain and crew are from Russia, Georgia, and the Philippines. The leaders of the hijackers, who calls himself General Ben claims he is a separatist. Last week, he threatened to blow up the tanker if the Nigerian government did not release a journalist from Radio Biafra who is jailed on terrorism charges. The security director for a risk management company in Denmark says the hijackers are probably using the political demand for release of the journalist as a cover for demanding money. The Nigerian government has made no comment on the hijacking, and the Benin Navy is still holding the tanker.
Human rights groups are calling on Cameroon to improve the conditions of its poor and chronically overcrowded prisons. Rights advocates say poor sanitation, inadequate food and water, and torture are rife in the prisons. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Yoko in central Cameroon.
26-year-old Penda Emmanuel has been jailed in Cameroon's Yoko prison for 4 years. He says he was handed a 7-year jail sentence for aggravated theft and attempted murder and was detained in a prison in Yaoundé for 2 years before transferred to the Yoko prison.
No, it is not good because in Yoko, first of all, there is no food. People are living, but we're hunting, all those type of things. That means if you are in prison of Yoko, you will suffer too much.
Pem Clement has been serving a life sentence for murder. He says lack of food and drinkable water, torture and inhumane treatment provoked a prison break when he was brought to the Yoko prison less than 10 years ago.
Les prisonniers avaient été évadés de cette prison et on avait envoyé les corps armés de
Yaoundé. He says the government called for troops from the capital Yaoundé before a reign of terror and massacres was reduced. He says people were asked not to go out after 6 p.m. when helicopters flew above to shoot at prisoners who were hiding in the bushes and had been raping women. He says many of them were killed and he does not know how many could have escaped. Cameroon's 78 prisons are built for a maximum capacity of 16,000 inmates. They now host 30,000 people, with a majority of them still awaiting trial. Some of the prisons, like the Kondenge prison in Yaoundé, were constructed to hold only 500 inmates. Today, it holds more than 2,000 inmates. Chemuta Divine, chairperson of Cameroon's National Commission on Human Rights and Freedoms, says the group is calling on the government to respect the rights of the prisoners by meeting their basic needs and giving them access to a fair trial.
You cannot be denying what is commonly known and where evidence is available. You rather accept that violations are going on and try to find the root cause and see how you can eradicate to ensure that that's not happening again.
Yoko Prison Registrar Mipui David says there have been efforts to improve conditions at the facility. He says the prison population has fallen from 3,000 inmates 2 years ago to less than 100 today.
La prison de Yoko se porte bien pour le moment. Et puis l'État fait.
He says the government has done a lot to improve living conditions in his prison, but they face an acute water shortage. David refutes allegations his prison has swelled from the arrest and detention of suspected Boko Haram terrorists who have been attacking northern Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad in an effort to create an Islamist state. Amnesty International reported in September that prisons in Cameroon were receiving a large number of Boko Haram suspects. It said the Marwa prison, near Cameroon's border with Nigeria, constructed for less than 500 inmates, was nearly half filled with Boko Haram suspects, and its 1,300 prisoners were housed without proper hygiene and health care. Cameroon has denied the accusations. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News in Yoko, Cameroon.
In a groundbreaking discovery, wildlife conservationists have confirmed that lions are living in a remote national park in Ethiopia. The discovery was made after a recent expedition supported by Born Free USA and the Born Free Foundation into the heart of the Alatash National Park in northwest Ethiopia on the country's border with Sudan. Adam M. Roberts is the CEO of Born Free USA and Born Free Foundation. He says the discovery of lions is exciting news given their steep decline across most of Africa.
Well, it was really important to Born Free and what we've declared 2016 as the year of the lion, that we try and have a full understanding of lion populations across Africa. And having heard anecdotal evidence that there might be a lion population in this remote area in Ethiopia bordering Sudan, we thought we should send a mission down there to check it out. And obviously they have come back with the really exciting news that there are lions there, possibly 100 to 200 in the region. And this suggests to us that we have a more sensible way to look at conservation strategies when we know the populations on the ground, where lions are, and where they're in need of protection. So while on the one hand we're working vigorously to try and force laws and get new laws enacted to protect the species, we also have to make sure we're doing our field conservation work on the ground as well. And information like this gives us an opportunity to do so.
What is the reaction of the government in terms of helping to protect the lions?
Well, the Ethiopia government and the Ethiopian Wildlife Conservation Authority specifically has been a really strong advocate for wildlife conservation and a partner with Born Free in trying to protect wild lions in the wild, but also rescue individual lions in need and keep them safe in lifetime care at a Born Free facility there in Ethiopia. So we have a very good relationship with the Ethiopian government, and they take this type of conservation work, especially for lions, the national symbol, very seriously. So we think the government will be strongly behind any protection efforts that we need to do to enhance the long-term viability and conservation of this particular population.
How do you think trophy hunting will fit into this picture?
Presumably not at all. Of course, it shouldn't, and trophy hunters, you know, definitely shouldn't be killing lions. And thankfully, Born Free was at the forefront of the effort last year, a successful effort to get the lion listed under the Endangered Species Act so that American trophy hunters won't be able to kill lions and bring the trophies back into America. But the lions in this area should be fully protected. They're in national park areas. There is no hunting there. And of course, you know, the people in that area have lived with these lions for some time, so it's not news to them, but we don't think there'll be any interest in trying to hunt these lions. It would obviously be a foolhardy effort for trophy hunters to suggest that now we've found this remote and very small population of lions, a vulnerable and imperiled species, that they would try and hunt them again.
What does this mean for the ecosystem of that region?
Well, obviously, when we try and protect individual species, individual animals of a species, we always want to look at the effect that removal of those animals would have on the ecosystem and keep these ecosystems whole and complete. So obviously, anything that we can do to protect the ecosystem as a whole by making sure that the animals there are protected from external influences will benefit, again, the long-term viability of that species. So I think, you know, the more we can do to protect these whole areas, the better.
Is there a possibility that some of these lions would be moved to another location for conservation?
I don't think so. I think the best thing to do is to protect this population in the national park in Ethiopia and the bordering conservation unit in Sudan and make sure that they're protected in perpetuity. There shouldn't be any reason to move them. It's a very remote area, and obviously all we can do to keep them there and safe, the better.
And in doing that, what is going to be your next step from here?
Well, now we will be talking to the Ethiopian government to make sure that we have all of the mechanisms in place to protect the species throughout the country, but in this particular area long term, and then trying to do more surveys, large carnivore surveys, throughout Ethiopia, East Africa, and indeed anywhere across Africa we can, to have a true understanding not only of how many lions and other large cats there are in the areas, but also how many there are, where they are, and where they need protection the most.
Adam M. Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA and Born Free Foundation. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Burundi's government wants allegations of Burundi refugees being recruited by rebels investigated. Health officials are moving quickly to raise awareness about the Zika virus. And a previously unknown large pride of lions has been discovered in Ethiopia. Coming up, we'll have music from Senegal and in our feature segment, the need to reduce income inequality in South Sudan. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheya Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have some kudos for Mali football.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the Eagles of Mali, who beat the Elephants of Ivory Coast Thursday 1-0 to advance to the African Nations Championship football final in Kigali, Rwanda. With the match heading into stoppage time, Mali got the game-winning goal from Yves Bissouma in the 89th minute. He powered his way into the Ivory Coast box and beat his man before finishing from close range to secure Mali's berth in Sunday's final in Kigali. The Eagles will play the Leopards of the Democratic Republic of Congo for the trophy. The Leopards, who won the inaugural CHAN competition for local players in 2009, beat Guinea 5-4 on penalty kicks in the first semifinal on Wednesday. So once again, the final is set at the fourth edition of the African Nations Championship in Kigali, Rwanda, Mali against the Democratic Republic of Congo on Sunday in Kigali, Rwanda. From Rwanda, let's go south to Zimbabwe, where football fans can be seen wearing the jerseys of their favorite clubs. And as Michael Cariati reports from Harare, most of these fans are showing their support for top European clubs.
Walking down the streets anywhere in Zimbabwe, one is bound to come across Manchester United, Arsenal, Barcelona, Real Madrid, Chelsea, and Liverpool replica jerseys, too many to count. Here and there, far and in between, that is when one comes across a Dynamos, Highlanders, or a Caps United jersey being put on. This is just the opposite of neighboring South Africa, where replica jerseys of Mamelodi Sundowns, Kaizer Chiefs, and Orlando Pirates are worn everywhere. Although there are others who put on replica jerseys of foreign teams, most of them are foreign nationals who live and work in that country. Football analyst Wallace Mawire says Zimbabwean football has lost its respect to the extent that local football followers have found solace in foreign clubs where they are guaranteed satisfaction.
The supporters are now looking to outside sporting teams where they get satisfaction from. The local teams, I think they've been demoralized by the performance.
Caps United follower Patrick Mombeshora adds his voice to the debate, saying Zimbabwean football standards have sunk so low to the extent that not many still want to be associated with the local game.
Our standard of football is very low, so people are excited by those international foreign teams.
Another football fan, Ephraim Gwavava, said he was saddened by Manchester United's 1-0 defeat to Southampton. Ironically, on the same day, the Warriors had lost 1-0 to Mali and eliminated from the CHAN finals. However, former Caps United defender Kudzanai Mkucha, who now coaches Zifa Northern Region Division 2 outfit Dilo Aces, strongly believes that Zimbabwean domestic football is still among the best on the continent. Mokocha says Zimbabweans in general have a big problem.
Okay, Zimbabweans have a problem. They don't respect themselves, one. They are excited by foreign things. If we are not good enough, why are South African clubs buying our players? You see, why did we qualify for Chad if we don't have good players in Zimbabwe?
The former Cup Kings defender says it is not surprising that Zimbabweans have their own favorite foreign teams, arguing that in Europe you get some people who follow and support Zimbabwean clubs.
I can say everyone is allowed to support whatever club you want. So some people have got their foreign clubs that they want outside. So we can even have people in Europe now who support Dynamos, who support Highlanders, who support Chicken Inn. So it's normal to support players around the world.
Mombeshora also added that jerseys for local clubs are not found in shops, as the shop owners believe there is no market for them.
They are not available in the shops. Actually, there are few. You can only find a few jerseys for just about big teams, Capes United and Highlanders and Dynamos.
However, Zimbabwe Football Association Chief Executive Officer Jonathan Mashingaidze claims Warriors jerseys are there in abundance, contending that they have an agreement with their kit sponsors to provide replica jerseys for sale to the public. Of late, a large number of local football fans have also been watching mostly European football on television, abandoning watching Kasolaga, Premier Soccer League, or Warriors matches. Mawire says he has observed that people have resorted to watching television soccer instead of PSL soccer matches in order to save money.
People, they either tend to watch on television rather than wasting their monies going to pay where they know that the results of the outcome will be disappointing to them.
Former Premier Soccer League Chief Executive Officer Chris Sambo suggests that the Premier Soccer League should come up with ideas to make the game more attractive and bring back the fans who have deserted the stadium. Edward Tembo, who won the league title with Motor Action in 2010 and is now on the books of Harare City, adds his voice to the debate, saying the game in Zimbabwe is as good as any in Africa, but points out that there is need for more knockout tournaments to retain the interest of old.
Football in this country is as good as any in Africa countries. The only problem is that there are less tournaments and less sponsorship in this country. This has made it less exciting.
However, another of the football followers, Kingston Marange, is of the opinion that most people have lost interest in local football due to the betting syndrome that has gripped the country.
This has been driven by the coming in of soccer betting. People now spend most of their time doing soccer betting, so that's why they're putting foreign jerseys.
He says in Zimbabwe, football betting has become a source of employment, as most people have lost their jobs and are unemployed. However, the truth is that there is betting in other countries, but they still take their time to support their own clubs. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariati.
The National Basketball Association champion Golden State Warriors beat my favorite club, the Washington Wizards, 134-121 here in Washington Wednesday night, playing at Verizon Center Arena, just a few blocks from our Voice of America headquarters. The Warriors got another spectacular performance from Stephen Curry, their star guard, who is the league's reigning most valuable player. Curry dazzled the crowd with his long-range shooting. He fired in 51 points. Count them, 51 points,
33 of those points came off three-point shots. Steph tied a career high by making 11 three-point shots. His great performance overshadowed another great game by Washington's all-star guard, John Wall, who scored 41 points and had 10 assists. Before the game, the Warriors met with President Obama at the White House. President Obama's favorite sport is basketball, and he praised the Warriors for winning their first NBA title in 40 years last June. In other NBA news, the five-time champion San Antonio Spurs remained unbeaten at home this season, beating the New Orleans Pelicans 110-97. It was San Antonio's 27th consecutive victory at home this season. LaMarcus Aldridge scored a season-high 36 points for the Spurs. Anthony Davis, the young star for New Orleans, had 28 points and 10 rebounds. In another game played in Texas, the Miami Heat defeated the host Dallas Mavericks 93-90. Chris Bosh scored 20 points for Miami, while Dwayne Wade had 18 points. Elsewhere, Kevin Durant hit a three-point shot with less than a second left in the game to lift the Oklahoma City Thunder to a thrilling 117-114 victory over the Orlando Magic. Durant finished with 37 points for the Thunder, while Oklahoma City star guard Russell Westbrook had 24 points, a career-high 19 rebounds, and 14 assists. Our VOA basketball fans will remember that's what we call a triple-double, double figures in three different statistical categories. Russell Westbrook is one of the NBA's great all-around players. This was his third consecutive triple-double. If you're just tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Mali beat Ivory Coast Thursday 1-0 to advance to Sunday's African Nations Championship football final in Kigali, Rwanda. Yves Bissouma scored the game-winning goal for the Eagles of Mali in the 89th minute. In Sunday's final in Kigali, the Eagles will play the Leopards of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The DRC beat Guinea 5-4 on penalty kicks in the first semifinal on Wednesday. And while Ivory Coast lost in Kigali today, the country's senior national team is currently ranked number one in the latest, number one in Africa in the latest FIFA rankings released on Thursday. Ivory Coast is number one. The Blue Sharks of Cape Verde, number two in Africa, according to FIFA. Algeria is ranked third in Africa, followed by Ghana and Senegal. Rounding out the top 10 African teams, according to FIFA, we have the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia at number six, Congo Brazzaville at number seven, Egypt at number eight, DR Congo at number nine, and Guinea at number 10 in the FIFA rankings released on Thursday. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, our fourth installment of a series on people producing top-quality food in South Africa. And next, the need to reduce income inequality in South Sudan. Done. But for some music, here is Titi Fakon of Senegal with Love You.
I'm
Senegal's Titifa Khan would love you.
Well, a businesswoman and farmer has established a company selling chili sauce that's winning widespread acclaim in South Africa. But the road to the top for Leko Nkala has been filled with many unusual twists and turns. Darren Taylor reports in the fourth installment of a series on people producing top quality food in South Africa.
Another winner inside Monte Cassino, Johannesburg's plush palace of gambling. It's not the likeliest of settings to find a chili farmer, but it's where Leko Nkala regularly delivers bottles of her chili sauce. Today, the tall woman in her mid-30s doesn't look much like a farmer. She's wearing a colorful summer dress, scarlet lipstick, and diamond earrings. Nevertheless, farming is in Nkala's blood. She grew up in her father's fruit orchard and on her grandparents' vegetable farm in Northwest Province.
School holidays, you sort of get like grounded. You know, you're not going to play. Are you crazy? You're staying home and helping mom can peaches or making jam. That's a technique or like a process of canning that I learned back then that I'm using now in my business.
So from a young age, Nkala was making juice, preserves, dried fruit. But she says the path towards owning a food production company only started in earnest a few years ago when she was managing this branch of a large Italian restaurant chain. Nkala says she grew tired of serving people chopped green chilies swimming in olive oil as a condiment. So she started making her own, more interesting sauce.
So the basic sauce that I first started with, it just so happened to be a chili sauce because I love chili. I put it in everything, even in cheesecake. So for me, it's always like chili first before salt, you know? So if something is blind,
a food technologist helped Nkala refine her ideas.
From the onset, I said to her, I don't want to put any preservatives in it. Whatever that we produce, it has to be made out of fresh ingredients and no preservatives, no nothing.
She grew her most important ingredients, the chilies themselves, on her father's and grandfather's farms.
My favorite is a jalapeno. I love jalapenos. So red jalapenos any day, no problem. I'll gobble them up very quickly.
But Nkala needed more of the fiery peppers. She sourced them from a group of women farmers also in her home province. First, she cooked up her sauce at home, experimenting until she dropped, and chopping chilies until she says she was literally on fire.
It just burns you. It goes into your pores.
Then Nkala added a secret blend of African herbs to the sauce. She eventually settled on using a chili cultivar she says is of medium heat.
It's hot with flavor. That was the whole purpose, to say, don't kill the flavor of my food, enhance it. You know, get in there, step it up a bit.
Nkala says chili sauce is often too smooth. Hers had texture and bite, but not too much bite. She tested her creations, a sweet and sour chili sauce and a chili herb relish, at markets and food shows.
The response that we got, it was, oh my gosh, overwhelming. And then we started cooking until we couldn't keep up. So from the home kitchen, we moved into like my double garages. It's like, yay, like, oh wow, we're growing, you know?
Her sauce proved so popular, she had to move into a factory and employ a team to help her produce more. She called her company Chiladido. Nkala ascribes the demand to her use of fresh organic ingredients, like freshly pressed olive oil from one of South Africa's top olive farms. Her sauces are now available at supermarkets around the country and in restaurants like the Brooklyn Brothers franchise.
We supply them in buckets, and then they use it, you know, at the back of the store to put it in burgers, and they have a whole burger named after our product, you know, which is nice. So they put it in there.
Inside the eatery, Denise Ntuli devours crispy fries slathered with Chiladido relish.
It tastes yummy, not too hot, and just nice, enough oil and perfect. It's balanced. It's even chunkier than the other sauces. I can eat the whole bottle.
Nkala describes her sauces as extremely versatile, mixing well with meat in omelets and on pizza.
For barbecuing, you mix it with butter and then you put it in a French loaf. Instead of having garlic bread, you can also have a chili loaf. And then you can mix it with a smooth cheese or plain yogurt and use it as a dip for your veggie pieces or tacos.
Her business has had challenges, like the year a hailstorm wiped out chili crops in the northwest, and Nkala had to source peppers through another firm.
So they got like a wrong type of chili, like a very, very hot, like bird's eye type of chili. So I got in, I tasted, I'm thinking, oh hell no, we can't take this to market. So it was a disaster and it was a big batch. And it's just like, oh my gosh, we can't throw it away. What are we gonna do with it?
Taking a chance, Nkala added mayo to the excruciatingly hot mix, thereby creating one of her current top sellers, a creamy chilenaise. She's now planning a range of new sauces, her motto being prosperity through innovation. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
A Juba-based think tank says the yet-to-be-formed transitional government of national unity must reduce income inequality in South Sudan. In a paper released over the weekend entitled The Inequality and Economic Outcomes in Sub-Saharan Africa, the head of the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies says South Sudan should build an economy that benefits all. He says first thing it must do is provide education to young people. Mugume Davis and Awakaringi has more from Juba.
A recent report by the International Monetary Fund says income inequality in sub-Saharan Africa is one of the highest in the world. Ebony Center Managing Director Rual Achui Deng says income inequality negatively affects growth. And in a country like South Sudan, where money is controlled by a few elites, Deng says the capacity to buy goods and services is limited, which suppresses economic growth.
Economy needs more people to consume things so that producers can respond, produce more, and consume more. But if the income is in the hands of few, they can't consume much. And then the money, they either put it away in the country, in the banks, or in assets, in other things, or take it out of the country.
Deng says South Sudan's extreme high rate of illiteracy is one of the primary causes of income inequality, since most people don't have the skills to get a job. A 2009 Sudan Household Survey conducted before South Sudan's independence reported that more than 70% of the population was unable to read or write. There has been no updated surveys on South Sudan's illiteracy rate since that time, but it's believed the rate remains about the same. Deng says income inequality among South Sudanese women is particularly high, due in large part to cultural practices that deprive women of property and land rights, as well as equal access to education. At a public discourse on the Ebony Center report on Saturday, Sarah Yakub said most women in rural areas cannot afford to pay for even basic services.
If they don't know how to market their things, is the government not having a big role to sensitize women, to give them orientation, tell them how to add value to their products that they have, so that the products they have market. Tell them how to bring their products from where they are to the market.
Jacob, who works for Central Equatoria Women Union, says rural residents have far less income than those living in urban centers, because they cannot access markets for their produce. Youth activist Asentewa Eriani says the upcoming transitional government should create employment opportunities for the country's youth so they can earn a living.
People look at young people as troublemakers. They're here on the street all over. There's a bunch of boys who sleep on the street. They're increasing every day. People, one day somebody was talking about how this is dangerous. Nobody's asking, why are they on the street? What are we doing to keep them out of the street? More are coming to the street. That means there's a problem in the home. There's a problem in our society. But nobody is focusing, and I think it's a ticking time bomb.
More than 70% of South Sudan's population is under the age of 35, according to the National Bureau of Statistics. Eriani says young, unemployed people often end up engaging in illegal activities such as theft because they have no jobs and no money. Deng says the key to turning that around is education.
If you don't invest in education, and especially on girls' education, so they always say you kill two birds with one stone. So education will enable you to close the gender gap, and it will also enable you to close income inequality.
Deng says the government must also have good fiscal and legislative policies that is access to credit services. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Freedom is one of those deceptively vague terms that means different things to different people. It could be one's ability to express his or her thoughts without worrying about breaking the law, or to do as one pleases without the necessity to conform to others' expectations. But in the broadest sense, it means the ability to exercise one's political and civil rights and to affect through his or her own actions the course of one's life and future of his or her community. These freedoms are currently in decline, according to the recent World Freedom Report issued by Freedom House, an international organization that advocates for democracy and human rights. Of the 195 countries assessed, 86 were rated free, 59 partly free, and 50 were not free. The report notes that the lack of democratic gains around the world was conspicuous. The one notable exception was Tunisia, which became the first Arab country to achieve the status of free since Lebanon was gripped by civil war 40 years ago. By contrast, a troubling number of large, economically powerful, or regionally influential countries moved backward. Authoritarian governments found new and numerous ways to limit political participation and civil liberties, to quash criticism, to repress the efforts of journalists and bloggers to disseminate information, and to persecute minorities demanding better treatment. Still others sought to retain power by manipulating elections and election law. And finally, many states increased or implemented surveillance, restrictions on internet communications, and curbs on personal autonomy. This includes a number of democratic countries which instituted a variety of restrictions, particularly on foreign nationals, due to new pressures caused by attacks from terrorist groups and the struggle to resolve difficult issues centered on an unprecedented influx of refugees fleeing from regional conflicts, particularly the Syrian civil war. Denial of freedom by governments to citizens is at best a short-term solution that exacerbates the long-term problem. Repression stifles innovation and creativity. It throttles hope and ambition, thus curtailing economic prosperity and cultural rejuvenation. As President Obama told the United Nations General Assembly in September, repression cannot forge the social cohesion for nations to succeed.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.